This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When Mick Mulvaney became President Trump's budget director, he vacated his congressional seat in South Carolina's 5th District. In just 2 weeks, there will be a special election to fill that vacancy. It's one of 5 special contests around the country, being viewed by many as referenda on the Trump presidency. This hour, we will be dividing our time equally between both the Democratic and Republican candidates in that South Carolina district, which stretches from York and Lancaster counties down to the PD area of the Palmetto State. And we begin with the Republican nominee for the seat. Ralph Norman is a former member of the South Carolina House. He represented District 48 from 2005 to 2007 and again from 2009 to this year. He won the right to compete against his Democratic challenger in a May runoff, winning by just 221 votes. And Ralph Norman joins us for the first part of the program. Mr. Norman, welcome. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Mike.
You actually resigned your seat in the South Carolina House in order to run for this seat in Congress. So why do you want this job?
Well, we've got a tremendous opportunity to right the course this country's been going on, which for the last 8 years, in my opinion, has been downhill. I think the country spoke volumes when Donald Trump won. They elected a non-politician. They elected somebody that had no backing from the politicians in office, nor did it have the backing of the media. And they were voted for change, and I want to be a part of that. I would not have felt like this had Hillary Clinton won the election in 2016, but I'm excited about what we can do, and I think it was providential that Mr. Trump went in. I think we've got one shot at getting it right, and I hope we can do that.
You mentioned that he was a non-politician, and the same could be said of your opponent. Why is that a good thing?
Well, he's a non-politician, but he's got the right. He's a businessman. He's got the right views. Archie Parnell is an attorney. He has not lived in the state. He has not voted in South Carolina. He's lived most of his life in China. Two very different points of view and different people. Trump proved himself in the business arena. You don't build a $10 billion business for being naive and not knowing what's going on. And in my mind, he's the best candidate. He's the best fit for this job. Look what he did with the Supreme Court. And, you know, the pundits all said, is he a conservative? Is he not? What will he do when he had the opportunity to appoint that office, which in my mind, the Supreme Court was a pivotal point in this history. And the fact that he put up a true conservative is, in my mind, one of the greatest things he's ever done. And hopefully we can get some legislation passed that benefits the country.
I mentioned earlier that this is one of 5 races around the country that Democrats have put their hopes upon, and a lot of pundits are saying this is going to be seen as a referenda on the Trump presidency. Either people will continue to support Donald Trump, or they will be backing away from him because of what has happened in the first 100 or so days here. Do you think that's what this election is? Do you think it should be a referenda on the Trump presidency?
No, and I don't think it is. I mean, I've been around. We've got 11 counties, 688,000 people in the 5th District. Not one person has asked me about, do you think Mr. Trump was right on the Supreme Court? Was he right on Syria? When you go into the small towns that make up the 5th District, people are worried about jobs. They're worried about filling the empty spaces in their downtowns. A lot of the businesses would be expanding, but they can't find qualified workers. And so it's individualized to that level. But, you know, he won by 20 points in South Carolina. You had 110,000 new voters come out to vote. Now, are they apprehensive? Yeah. I mean, it's a scary time. Look what's happened all over the world, you know, with North Korea, with Syria. So, you know, people are uneasy, and rightfully so. That's why I'm so glad I'm in this race, so that I can be a part of it.
People keep saying, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's why I'm excited about being part of it, and hopefully we can come up with some good solutions.
Yeah, before we started on the air, I asked you why you wanted to be a part of this, and because no politicians can ever be right in some people's minds. And you pointed out the fact that politics is part of everybody's everyday life, whether they know it or not, whether they realize it or not. Every April 15th, they're involved in politics. Every time they get a paycheck from which taxes and Social Security, et cetera, have been deducted, they're involved in politics. So is that why you think you can do more in Washington than you could in the State House in Columbia?
Well, Washington is just a pivotal point. In my mind, I can't remember in my lifetime that conservatives have control of the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. I think with electing a non-politician as chief executive, as president, I mean, I think he'll put forth the ideas that we can actually do something on. I hadn't felt like that for the last 8 years. I pretty well, you know, Obama had no, I didn't trust him for whatever he said. I didn't really think he was in the best interest of the country. Look at what's happened since Trump's been elected. We can say Merry Christmas. He's put faith back in the political arena. And it's just been the things that he's gone to and this is the anniversary of D-Day. He pays homage to that. And he's brought out a new patriotism that I think America appreciates. I've been yearning for it. And he doesn't put his finger in the air to say which way is the wind blows. And he makes his own decision. He's going to get blasted by the media either way. And before I came on your show, I was thinking, what has the media supported him on anything? He's been in office 120 days. They've been downgrading him. Everything's wrong. And I'm sick of it. And I'm glad the American people are bypassing the media, and they don't trust them. And for the most part, they're following Trump, and they like what he's doing, in my opinion.
You had a reputation in the South Carolina House as being one of the most conservative members of that body. And before the president's first 100 days, you gave Mr. Trump a grade of A++. In your mind, what had he done to merit such a high grade, and would that grade be changed today? Would it be higher? Would it be lower? Would it be the same?
Well, I mean, the thing that I like about Trump, again, Supreme Court regulations, you know, with this executive order, but for every regulation proposed, he's cutting two. I like just the direction that he's sending. Now, people can criticize that, but, you know, the tweets, is that right or wrong? I don't know. People can read a tweet or they cannot read a tweet. It's optional. But I like what he did in Syria. I like getting out of the Paris Accord. So, I mean, he's taken a business approach to the country, to the spending and to the cuts. And look who he put with at OMB. Mick was one of the most conservative members of the House and when he was in the Congress. And, you know, he's taking that approach as he's looking at government. Now, we've got to do something. We've got to get it passed. The public is not buying, you know, the House passed it, the Senate won't. They want something done. And so the conundrum the conservatives are in is, as on health care, get something done. Get something on the table. And my first question to President Trump is, how are you going to deal with the Senate? In the House, we can propose all the legislation we want. If it's going to be stymied, how do we deal with that? How do you deal with the Chuck Schumer, with their rules and with their ability to block good legislation? The Democrats don't want the conservatives to win in anything. We got to figure out a way around that.
But couldn't the same have been said in the previous 8 years? I mean, I think it was Mitch McConnell who said it was going to be his job to obstruct everything President Obama wanted to do. How do we move past obstructionism on either side?
Well, with Obama, it was a lot of his policies were just bad. I mean, it wasn't a fact of stopping him. Rush Limbaugh was active. He wanted to stop him, but he wanted to stop his ideas. His liberal ideas, which are bankrupting the country. And so with Trump, and with the Congress, we've got to put the country first. We've got to be conservative. Conservatives control now, and it's our opportunity to, when we say we're going to cut government, we do it. We look at specific programs, and we sell it to the American people. I look forward to, as we get into particular issues, debating the pros and cons, And on some of them, it may be worth taking three-fourths of a loaf rather than nothing. But my question is, you know, the House can get to, as in the new health care plan. I don't think it's going to probably pass the Senate. Is it perfect? No. But at least it's as they say, it's the first step of a long stairway.
What,
so I look forward to having.
What would you advocate in terms of health care? The Republicans have been saying since the beginning of the Obamacare law being passed that it was their goal to repeal and replace it. Do you like what the House has put together for a proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, I like the expanding the HSA accounts. I like buying insurance across state lines. I think crafting each individual policy, letting the states opt out, not having the mandate that they join. We've got to do something with pre-existing conditions, but I think he's put that in a separate pool with state and federal subsidies. Is it perfect? No. But look at the alternatives. I mean, Tennessee lost Humana. 40-some thousand people without insurance. That's not an option. So, you know, it's not a perfection, but it's putting something that I think people can look at and make their own decision. But the way it was going for the last 7 years since it was put in place was not the course that it was sustainable. And you can tell the insurance companies are getting out because of the losses they had.
But some people would say that's because it was not successful in states where Republicans didn't expand Medicaid. And as the Congressional Budget Office, I think the number is 21 or 28 million people might lose their insurance under the proposed Republican plan. So are you worried about a backlash when people who are presently insured under Obamacare may lose their insurance if something new passes? Are you worried about that?
Well, it's something we have to address. I've got my job is however it plays out when it comes, and I expect it to come back from the Senate, probably with some revisions. Explain that to the voters of the 5th District. Say, this is what's proposed. This is what we have. President Trump has vowed that he's not going to leave the 24 million people out. He's vowed that those with pre-existing conditions are going to have a mechanism to have coverage. So, I mean, the alternative where rates were going up 50%, some higher, is not an option. And the insurance companies were losing money as it was and opting out of the program. South Carolina did not opt into the Medicaid. We rejected the expansion. You know, we were going to have to bear the brunt of the cost in 2020 anyway. So, but it's, again, I'm going to have to look at it. See what the alternatives are, and then come back to the voters in the 5th District and say, this is what we have, and this is why I voted the way I voted.
Is that a topic of conversation as you stump in your district around South Carolina, the Health Care Act, or what seems to be top of mind for voters there?
Mike, across the board, it's economics. Well, one, they want to get government out of their lives. They want to operate their business. They want to recruit business. They want a job. They want to, you know, feed their families. And yeah, the health care comes up a lot, but so does Social Security. So does, you know, securing the border. But it's more individually, it's different from each town, but it's a common theme, and that is economic security. Been able to feed the families, been able to run their business without outside influence.
We have to take a break. We'll come right back with more. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Iron Yard, offering full and part-time web development courses in Charlotte for career development. Enrollment is open. More info at theironyard.com/Charlotte. And DHG, a public accounting firm based in Charlotte, the people of DHG work to combine global assurance, tax, and advisory resources with the commitment to help you and your business succeed. Charlotte's homicide rate continues to rise. In 2017, we've experienced 38 murders as of this past weekend. CMPD says it's doing what it can to combat the problem by working in hotspots, seizing weapons off the street, and focusing on repeat offenders. But still, the murder rate continues to climb. So we're going to look at that and at what other city police departments are doing to get a handle on senseless violence on this program tomorrow morning at 9.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump turns to the nation's infrastructure this week and is floating plans to sell off highways and airports and privatize air traffic control. We look at how that would work. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join that conversation on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this part of the program with Ralph Norman, the Republican candidate in South Carolina's 5th Congressional District. He'll be going to a special election in 2 weeks to replace Mick Mulvaney as the congressman from that district because Mr. Mulvaney is now the budget director in the Trump White House. I interrupted you in the middle of a phrase. I'm sorry I had to do that, but we're back now. And there was an article in the Charleston Post and Courier that said your win in the Republican primary left Democrats more hopeful than they might have been that they could take this seat back because it belonged for a very long time, as we all know, to John Spratt, the Democrat. If you think they're wrong, why are they kidding themselves?
No, they could be very well right. And in a special election, a lot of people don't choose to come out. Voter apathy is the thing that worries me and every conservative, really, because we had, 7% turnout in the primary? And they can very well take this seat. I haven't been elected to anything. June 20th is the day that the people will either choose to put me in office or not. And the challenge is for people to go to the polls and take voting seriously, as I do. And They had Mr. Perez, head of the Democratic Party, in Gaffney this weekend. They're taking it very seriously. Now, it's not getting all the publicity. The 5th District isn't. Georgia and Montana and Kansas took a lot of the headlines, but still, we've got a race on our hands. I don't take it lightly.
You are, as I said earlier, considered to be very conservative, and one thing that same article in the Charleston Post and Courier mentioned was that when you were in the House, in the legislature in South Carolina, you voted against significant bipartisan majorities on a couple of bills, including one that would allow police officers to be eligible for workers' compensation if they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, there are usually a number of reasons why lawmakers vote for or against certain bills that on the face may seem ridiculous, but when you drill down deep, you find out that there were legitimate ideas or reasons why they did or did not vote. Why did you vote against that?
Very, very simple. The post-traumatic stress syndrome is very serious. The military has got issues with it, and are covered and should be covered. That was never part of it. But what I objected to was you had lawyers bringing this up. Mr. Folk put it out there. It was his bill. It was really a conflict of interest, to be honest with you. Any claim filed, they get 32% of it. I think he filed $3 million and he got $1 million, and I pointed that out, and rightfully so. The state in 2014 had $334 million in claims, and when you talk to this, wasn't put up by law enforcement. This was just put up by the attorneys who I felt like when you ask the policeman, they said it's going to break the system. And the potential for abuse, it's a problem. It's already covered in the state plan, but it didn't originate from long lines of policemen or firemen or other people, first responders, who do a great job. They weren't promoting this cause. It was those that benefited from it that were the ones that proposed this legislation. And when you look at the math, and I've met with several who took issue with me, had one that I met sat down at a coffee shop, showed him the numbers. He said, "Well, you're looking at it for the state." And I said, "I was." And, it's something I would vote the same way again and are eager to explain to anybody, once you look at the math and the cost for the state, why it should not be adopted.
You've also called for raising Social Security's retirement age and reducing benefits, Social Security benefits, for the top 10% of earners. Why raise the retirement age, and to what?
Well, no, here's the overall theme. Going bankrupt in 2034 is not an option. We cannot continue to kick the can down the road. One of the options, and I'm very strong in those that have bought into the system now, and I had a long conversation with a voter yesterday who supported me, but he said, am I protected? I said, absolutely. But can I make the case for a 20-year-old who may have to work a month long? Yes. Can I make a case for somebody that's a upper income earner that some of the benefits may have to be adjusted? Yes. Now, we've got to get it passed we've got to make change that we can adapt. But I'm tired of just kicking it down the road. We've got to put options on the table, and I think we will. And President Trump hadn't focused on that because he's been busy on other things.
I suppose it could be argued that if a person does well in life and they've made a lot of money and been able to put their own money aside, they don't need Social Security as much as somebody who has not done as well in life. But they still put that money into the system. So why should you penalize them for not being able to take it out?
Well, you shouldn't. You ought to have options to invest it yourself at some point. Look what's happening to it now. There's no trust fund. The money's not there that all of us have paid into. They're using it for debt on the country, paying bills for the country, which is wrong. You know, we've got worthless paper backing it up now. That, to me, is not an option. It's something to be considered. And you're right. It's there. It's our money. It's not the government's money. And what they're doing with it now is scandalous.
Elsewhere in the country, the National Republican Party has been pouring in resources in these special elections at the last minute to stave off Democratic inroads. Is that happening in the 5th District in South Carolina?
Well, you had a lot of parties. You had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce put in over $500,000 against me. Those that supported me, Club for Growth, came in. You had the Ted Cruz's of the world, the Jim DeMint's, who believe in what I'm doing, and my positions supported me. And so all your special, your groups that have an interest in Washington and how we vote got involved in this, which, you know, the U.S. Chamber was a complete shock in my mind.
Why are they not supporting a conservative?
Well, you need to ask them that. All I know is I've been paying into the chamber for 60 years, our business. And as I have to, when I called the state chamber and I said, I don't understand this. The chamber is supported by business, small business and large alike. And the response was, well, it was the national separate. I said, no, I get that. But you pay dues to the national, which they do. But the only thing I can figure is I'm a true conservative. I vote to give the money back to the people rather than let government spend it. And the chamber, the U.S. chamber, had some reason that they did not like that and went after me in a big way and in a primary put that $500,000 into this.
We have 30 seconds left, sir. There's a candidate forum set for June 9th in Rock Hill being advertised, and the AARP is putting together a debate at Winthrop University on the 12th. Will you participate in either of those events?
No, sir. Will not. I will be at a debate. Charles Beerbauer has got one, I think, next week. Look, I've had 7 debates. Mr. Parnell, I think, was at 3 of them. We've been on the stage with the Democrats for a long time, you know, during that time. And people know we're so different. They know where we stand. I'm campaigning all over the district. We've had this set for the last 3 weeks on my role and where I'll be. And it's not.
Okay.
Don't intend to do that.
Ralph Norman is the Republican candidate in South Carolina's 5th congressional district race, which will the vote will go be in 2 weeks from, I believe, today. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Mm-hmm. South Carolina's 5th congressional district seat in the United States Congress was held for years by Democrat John Spratt until Tea Party Republican Mick Mulvaney took the seat away. Now, another Democrat is working to take the seat back, and that would be Archie Parnell. Mr. Parnell is a first-time office seeker, a tax attorney, and former Goldman Sachs advisor with business experience on three continents, including Europe and Asia, and he is no stranger to Washington or the House of Representatives, having served as senior counsel for that U.S. House committee. And Mr. Parnell joins us now by phone. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
You are, as has been pointed out earlier in this program, a first-time politician. Why did you choose this race as your entry point into politics?
Well, I don't think I had a choice, actually. I saw what was happening in Washington, and I had to sort of step up. You're right to say that I've never done this before, but, the things that have happened since Trump was elected caused me to run for this seat.
What are those things?
I think things are going off the rails. He is travel banned, for example, the Paris Accords. That of course happened just recently. But Russia, another example. There are many examples.
Mm. Given your Goldman Sachs experience and the fact that you're a tax attorney, you sound more like a Republican than a Democrat, and you live in a district that has become increasingly Republican in recent years. Why should what appeared to be your increasingly Republican neighbors return this seat to the Democrats?
Well, I'm a moderate, basically. I am a Democrat. If you look at the history of the Democratic Party, there's a proud history of what's happened with the Democratic Party. They've done many marvelous things. If you look at women's suffrage, Social Security, GI Bill, Civil Rights Act, all of those things are something that should be applauded. I think we need to stop shouting at each other, however, on issues between the Republicans and the Democrats. Ralph Norman was just on your program, and I heard the very end saying that he and I had been on several debates. We were four debates where they had all of the Democrats, all of the Republicans together before the primary, and I was the only one that said at each of those debates that it was a good thing that we're sitting on the stage together, because it's a good thing that we talk to each other, because the only way to get things done is to talk to each other and stop shouting at each other. I was the only one to say that in the first debate, and I thought people would pick it up in the second debate. They did not. And I said it each time throughout all four debates, I strongly believe that we have to work together. I'd like Congressman Spratt has endorsed me, and he was a congressman that reached across the aisles. I'd like to model myself after Congressman Spratt and emulate Congressman Spratt if I'm elected.
And I think there are people out there who want that, but there are also people out there who feel that they go to the polls to elect people like your predecessor in this race, Mick Mulvaney, because he was a Tea Party Republican and he had a certain ideology, and they did not want him to veer off that ideology one iota. And if you do veer, then you are a traitor to the cause. How do we get beyond that and go back to a time when compromise, which is the only way you ever get anything done, is a reality?
Well, again, as I just said, I mean, we have to be civil toward each other, thoughtful in our approach. I think that's something that I bring to this. As you alluded to, my background is one that after law school at the University of South Carolina, I was at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. as a trial attorney, then on the staff of the Ways and Means Committee for a number of years. And then I was in the tax departments of two of the biggest U.S. corporations that do business around the world. So I have a combination of both business experience and government experience that I think I can, in a civil and thoughtful and prudent way, try to solve problems rather than shouting at people.
You've said that Washington policies are hurting middle-class families. But isn't it the middle-class families who voted for Donald Trump and not for Democrats? So if that's the case, how do you fix that?
Well, I think that in this particular election, there's a very, very clear choice between the two candidates. Take, for example, Social Security. I want to protect that. I think people, when they have FICA taxes, payroll taxes withheld, every time they get paid, they've earned that. And I think my opponent wants to abolish Social Security or change it drastically. I want to protect Social Security and Medicare. And I think that middle-class families, as well as families across the board, benefit from Social Security. As I said just a moment ago, that one of the highlights of the Democratic Party was under President Roosevelt, FDR, when Social Security was put in place. I also want to focus on jobs, and I want to grow help small businesses grow. For example, my opponent voted against disaster relief for our farmers, and that certainly does not help members of the 5th District.
As a candidate, Donald Trump rallied or railed against companies moving operations overseas and hiding profits overseas, and you say your background as a tax attorney will allow you to help to revise the tax code to close loopholes that allow those companies to keep untaxed profits overseas and use that money to cut taxes for families. Is that a realistic expectation for a first-term congressman and also a first-time politician?
Well, I mean, the issue of profits that have been stashed overseas, and at this point, I think the latest statistic on that is that there's $2.7 trillion of profit that are kept overseas by multinational corporations that are not taxed by the United States. And there's been a lot of discussion about that over the past number of years, both with respect to some of the House Ways and Means Republican congressmen. And I believe that we can step forward and get that and do that actually have that part of the tax code changed.
How would your previous experience as an attorney for the House Ways and Means Committee aid you in those efforts?
Well, two ways. Firstly, I know the particular provision in the Internal Revenue Code that needs to be amended, and I could actually draft the legislation myself to do that. I also know the process by which the tax laws are changed, having been involved in that as a staff attorney for the Ways and Means Committee. So I know the substantive side of the law, and I know the process. And so I think those two things combined make me a unique candidate, for this particular role at this particular time.
What do you see as the biggest problems? I mean, we've just gone through a presidential election where we had this conversation about what challenges face America today and what the people want. What do you see as the biggest challenges, not only for the country, but for people in the 5th Congressional District in South Carolina?
Now that's a very, very big question. I think that, jobs in South Carolina, is something that is if you just look at a particular statistic that is sort of frightening, one third of the jobs in South Carolina pays less than $25,000 a year, and it's that's very, very difficult, to make ends meet these days. And so, what we need to do is get better paying jobs, in the 5th District, for the constituents of the 5th District, and there are many ways to go about that.
Well, let me stop you because we have to take a break, and I'll let you finish that comment and get to some of the ways we go about getting better paying jobs in the 5th Congressional District when we come back from this 90-second break. Archie Parnell is our guest, the Democrat in South Carolina's 5th Congressional District, for which there will be an election in 2 weeks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Charlotte Squawks 13, a musical parody that takes aim at everything from pop culture and sports to traffic and politics. Now through June 25th at the Booth Playhouse. Tickets at 704-372-1000. And N.C. Warren, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarren.org. With the healthcare repeal stalled and tax reform still just an idea, President Trump looks to infrastructure for his first major legislative accomplishment. He's starting with a proposal to privatize the nation's air traffic control system. Other infrastructure spending would lean heavily on the private sector and local governments. Can this plan get off the ground? They'll be taking a look at that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point with guest host Anthony Brooks. And we'll continue in just a moment.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
President Trump has said the U.S. is now out of the Paris Climate Accord. In his speech in the Rose Garden yesterday,
it's your community. We help you understand it.
this city loved Rudy Wright. He had a lot of friends, just a fine man, and then also a fine mayor.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're spending this hour talking to the two congressional candidates in the 5th Congressional District in South Carolina. We spent some time with Ralph Norman, the Republican candidate, in the first part of the program. Now we're talking to Archie Parnell, the Democrat candidate. And you were talking about better paying jobs for people in South Carolina, and particularly in the 5th Congressional District, where most jobs, I think you said, paid less than $25,000 a year. How do you attract better jobs? How do you get employers to offer better pay?
Actually, it was one in three jobs okay. in South Carolina pay less than $25,000. But I think that would be like everything. You have to approach it on many levels. One is that infrastructure. We need to improve the infrastructure in the state to make it attractive place in which to do business. And then, in addition to that, we need to have job training. We need just better training in the state. We have tech schools already, but we also need, to roll out more apprenticeship programs and so forth. That would obviously help. I had I've gone through the 11 counties of this district on multiple occasions over the last period and met with so many people within the district. And one of the places that we visited in York was a company called Anderson Hydra, which is locally owned, and it builds those platforms that raise up under portable platforms that can be raised up under bridges in order to inspect and repair bridges. Obviously, something that fits into the infrastructure theme, and it's the only company in the United States that manufactures these kind of this kind of machinery. Those people are spot on the way they approach the business, the way they treat their employees. The way they share the business line that they're in, I think the way they want to help the community. So I think that that's an example of a company right here in South Carolina right now that's in the sweet spot, if you will, of what needs to go across the country in terms of infrastructure. You need skilled people doing those jobs. It's a growing company. We need to have more of that here in the 5th District, and I was very, very happy to meet with the folks at Anderson Hydro Platforms, and I think that we just need to do more of that in this district, and I think again infrastructure and job training are those things.
President Trump attracted voters to him because of his populist message and his promise to help the downtrodden in America, the middle class and the lower middle class, and people like coal miners and things like that. And he carried your district by 20 points in the fall. Is your message a populist message? You're talking about middle-class workers and raising wages. Will they respond to you the way they responded to the president?
Well, I certainly am. I am from a working family. My father was a veteran in World War II that went to the Army Air Corps after World War II. He was a decorated World War II veteran, and then he was an Air Force mechanic, Master Sergeant in the Air Force, and he retired in Sumter, South Carolina, where I was educated as in elementary school as well as graduated high school in Sumter. And so I come from a working family, and that's who I am, and that's who I want to help. I think if we help each other together, this is a we thing. We have to do things together, and by doing things together, we will make our lives together better. And so if you want to call that populist, I guess you can. I call it respect for my neighbors and loving the country.
Democrats have had their base awakened because of their defeat in the fall and because of some of the things that the president has and has not done since coming into office. But do you think Democrats have the strength to take back your district, a district that, as I said, the president won by 20 points in the fall? Is it unrealistic to believe that it can be flipped in this race back to Democrats?
Yes, without question. I say that for two reasons. I mean, one is, just talking with the voters face to face and talking with them about their concerns and listening to what they have to say. I'm convinced that we will win the race on that basis alone. But I sort of buttressed that feeling with a poll that we had taken just before Labor Day, Memorial Day, the Friday before Memorial Day, and that poll showed that if you compare the November 2016 congressional race where Mick Mulvaney won by 21.5%. As of that Friday before Memorial Day, the margin was 10%. And so that's more than half, a catch up, if you will, on the Republican side. More importantly than that, though, I think the poll also demonstrated that the energy and enthusiasm of our voters, surpasses substantially the energy and enthusiasm on the Republican side.
What was the turnout in the Democratic primary down there?
Do you mean this particular time?
Yes.
This list, I think there are about 19,000 or so voters in the primary on May 2nd.
You told NBC. Go ahead.
So you're pointing out something that's very clear, and that is, voters need to come out and vote. There is a very, very clear choice that they have. It's a stark difference between my opponent and myself. And I think that if the voters come out, and when I say voters, I'm talking about, voters from across the political spectrum, because it's, in my view, it is not, whether it's a Republican idea, a Democratic idea, an independent idea, what matters is that it's a good idea. And if it's a good idea, that's what we're going to be doing. That's what that's what we're pushing. That's what we're trying to bring forward. And so I think that your point about 19,000 Democratic voters in the primary is a good point, and we have to ensure that we get the vote out.
You told NBC that as you go around your district, you're sensing buyer's remorse about Trump. What are people saying to you about that, and what are you saying to them that seems to be getting their attention or maybe even garnering you some support?
Different people are obviously different, so different people have different reactions. That's a truism. But, I think that there's some people that are just a little concerned and perhaps, shading over to being a bit frightened, he's a bit unpredictable. And I think that there's some buyer's remorse in that. And I think that what you need is someone with a civil and thoughtful approach, and that is certainly my approach. I'd like to be the adult in the room. If Donald Trump does something that I disagree with, I will fight him tooth and nail. If there are things that that we can agree on, perhaps parts of infrastructure we could agree on, we would work together. I do think that, people have pointed out very recently the concern about so many people that would be kicked off of health care insurance, 23, 24 million people kicked off under the recent Congressional Budget Office estimates. That's something that's very, very concerning to a number of people. The change in pre-existing conditions is also something that people talk with me about quite regularly now that that bill in the House was voted on. And so, I do think that there is considerable difference between my opponent, because he said he would support the House health bill, I think the ACA should be fixed. You don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, if you will.
Your opponent and I talked about his support for the Republican proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act in the last segment, and a lot of people didn't like the Affordable Care Act because they called it Obamacare until they found out that some of the provisions of that act were actually helping them. And Democrats have gotten in their way and fallen all over themselves in cases because they've never really come to the defense of the Affordable Care Act. What would you say to people about health care in America? Is it a right? Is it a privilege? Is the Affordable Care Act in fact failing? And where it's failing, why is it failing?
Well, I mean, you know, it is clear to say that the affordable health care is not perfect. You know, I think my opponent on your prior segment said that the House bill is not perfect. He's trying to distance himself from what he said earlier about the House health care bill. It is not perfect, but again, you know, it is certainly a step in the right direction. And what we need to do is to fix the affordable health care and not repeal it. We need to improve it. Things evolve. You know, as we each know in our life, you know, things are not perfect. I mean, you have to work with what you have and try to improve things. You don't just throw things away just because necessarily you don't like them. You have to take steps to try to improve things. And we have distinct ideas about how to improve the Affordable Health Care Act, so that 23 million people are not kicked off of health care. The other thing that I want to mention about the Health Care Act is that, you know, it's called the Health Care Act, but in large portion, it is a tax refund, a tax break for the very, very wealthy. You know, it eliminates a surcharge on capital gains on stocks and bonds, you know, generated by the wealthy. And that loss of revenue, $600 billion over 10 years, needs to be made up, or was made up in under the House health care bill by, you know, reducing the expansion of Medicaid, as well as eliminating parts of the Children's Health Insurance Program. And so what you have under the Republican Health Act is a shift of the burden to those people that can least afford it, and giving much money, so much money to the wealthy. You've seen Warren Buffett has described that if this law were in place in the last year, his individual tax bill, you know, would have gone down 17%. He said that. He said that that's not justified. You know, we again, this is about we and not about, you know, me. I mean, you know, it's not about the wealthy. We're in all of this together.
Republicans point to the failing of Obamacare on so many levels, rising insurance premiums, the withdrawal of a lot of insurance companies from certain areas of the country, including North and South Carolina, because they found this unsustainable for their business model. Why is that? And can that be fixed?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things that we can do. I mean, firstly, on the cost of prescription drugs, prescription drugs have risen a great deal over the recent past. And one of the proposals I think we should talk about is changing the rules so that people are permitted to import prescription drugs from outside the country. We can buy shirts and other things from Canada. Why can't we buy prescription drugs? I think as long as the prescription drugs are safely manufactured, we're talking about FDA-approved drugs, and that you have a doctor's prescription, a system would have to be put in place for this, but we could import drugs at a much lower cost than what drugs are now sold for in the United States. There are a number of reasons why things are cheaper outside the country, but that's one thing that we could think about. The other thing that we could think about is, at the moment, you know, under the ACA, people opt into insurance, and then if they don't, they are penalized with a tax penalty at the end of the year. You know, and I think academic studies have shown that when people join new employers and they're given all these forms to fill out for, you know, for health care, for retirement, you know, for their wage withholding, and they're given all of these when they're joining their employer. You know, studies have been done where there are pre-populated forms with sort of default choices made, as compared to those where there are no choices made and people have to make their choice. that the pre-populated forms, that works out better. And so I think that one thing that we should think about and talk about is have a default system so that people are automatically in an insurance plan, as opposed to having to opt into an insurance plan.
We have about
They could opt out if they like.
We have about 90 seconds left. About 90 seconds left in this program today. What kind of support are you getting from the National Democratic Party? Are you getting enough money or support of other kinds to mount a serious campaign against a very conservative challenger, a relatively well-known Republican in your district and in a Republican district?
Well, this past Saturday, the Democratic chair came and visited, and we also had Martin O'Malley visiting and campaigning with us. There's growing support from the Democratic National Committee, and as well as the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. I think you probably read news reports overnight that there's additional support that's coming in, and so there's growing support nationally. And there's also, I can say that we've gotten contributions from each of the 50 states. We've had over close now 14,000 contributions. People around the country see this as a very important race. I've been talking with Congressman Clyburn quite a lot about this race, and during one discussion, he sat back and looked toward the ceiling and reflected by saying, Archie, this race is actually bigger than us. It's bigger than this particular campaign. This is a very important election. This is an election that will send a signal to Washington. This is about also the constituents of the 5th District.
And with that, we have to let you go because we're completely out of time. Archie Parnell is the Democratic candidate in South Carolina's 5th Congressional District. The election is in 2 weeks. Thanks for your time.